We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Our guest today is Professor Brant Houston. Welcome, Brant.
Thank you.
Brant is in the Knight Chair of Investigative and Enterprise Reporting in the Journalism Department of the College of Media here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. How long have you been here in this university, Brant?
I came here in the fall of 2007.
So, and where were you before that?
I was down at the University of Missouri at the Journalism School, but actually mostly running a nonprofit professional association.
What kind of association was that? What did it do?
It's called Investigative Reporters and Editors, and it's actually been around since 1975. In fact, I joined it way back when, in 1979. And what it does is it provides, I would say, the best professional training for reporters and editors in the world. It has a way of passing down knowledge from senior people down to people just getting into the business. And whether they're investigative or not, it's giving them great reporting and editing techniques in all media.
And today on Keeping the Faith, we're going to be talking with you about some a journalism project you're doing, directing here at the University of Illinois in our setting in Champaign-Urbana, looking at the poverty in this area?
Yes. When I came here,
County, I guess.
Yeah, it's really the county. When I came here, I was looking at some census data, and I was a little surprised at the poverty rate. And that was even correcting for students who sometimes are counted by the census and not. And it seemed there were a number of issues that could be covered and would help the community. And so working with the News Gazette and working with the journalism department at the university, and then the Knight Foundation, which is based in Miami, is responsible for my chair, we put together some grant money, and we were able to hire staff and create a website and do reporting, and we're involving students, and we're starting to work with the Graduate School of Library Information and Science, too. And also, we've just moved into some desk here at WILL.
Oh.
So it's a large collaboration to look at issues that if you went through the county each day, you might not see otherwise.
Now, this program is heard, of course, a lot more broadly than just Champaign County. Everywhere between Chicago and Indianapolis, there are a lot of counties probably like Champaign, maybe not with a big university in them, but I would have thought that a county with a large university and two big hospitals would be pretty immune on the face of it to real poverty.
Well, we're an interesting county in that we both have the aspects of urban poverty and rural poverty. And once again, I think my expectation was exactly what you said when I came here. And of course, looking at statistics and data is one thing. That's the lab work. You have to get out in the field. And as we've worked on this, we've discovered a lot of things that might not see people. I think John Foreman had an article today, an opinion piece, talking about hidden poverty in the county. We may expand this out into central Illinois, but we wanted to start with a project that was containable. It was easily contained. One county is plenty when you're starting to try out something new. And part of what we're doing has a lot of community engagement in it. So this was not your usual news project. It wasn't something we were going to work on for 6 to 8 months and then publish 4 or 5 stories in the paper. This has a Facebook page. This has web. There's Twitter. We're using, every medium there is. And we're also looking to establish some community information and news centers where students and the staff and faculty and citizens can get together and talk about the issues and some of the underserved parts of the community.
Now, is the use of all these various sorts of media a way to get information or to pass on the information that you found?
Great question. It's both.
Both.
It's both. You know, we're getting used to how effective new media can be. The
Look
best
at
way
Egypt,
to use it.
Yeah.
And to gather information, I think we tend to think of new media first as, oh, a new way to present.
Sure.
But we're finding that that's a lot of new ways to gather the information.
So are you at the place yet that you would like to mention on the air how people could find a website or find Facebook?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I want to mention there's some real key players in this. I've been working really the co-coordinator Project Director on this is Rich Martin, who is now the interim department chair. But he came from management, managing editor of the Roanoke paper before he came here a number of years ago. And another key player in this is Pam Dempsey, who is a grad of the department and also a former News Gazette employee. Same with Dan Petrella, another one. And then a real key person in this is Acton Gorton, who I call one of our bridge people. He's a journalist. He's a web administrator. He's now a grad student at the Library Information Science School. These are people without whom this wouldn't happen. But it's called cu-citizenaccess.org. And I believe, of course, the usual c-u-citizenaccess.org. I think we've got that one, too. So you'll find it pretty easily with that.
cu-citizenaccess.org.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. So listeners who would like to find out what this project is about and participate in it may go to that site and become involved to what extent you would choose. Let me reintroduce our guest for people who may have tuned in a little late, Professor Brant Houston. And his last name is, let's see, I think you told me it's like that city in Texas.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Houston, right. Or Houston to those that live in New York City. But it's Houston.
Of course, there are some people from Texas who think there's only one city in Texas, and that's Austin.
Right. Right.
When you first came here to the University of Illinois from Missouri, were there any changes, or were the two universities and states and cities very similar?
It's one of those things. There are a lot of similarities, and then there are differences. The similarities are, a good Midwest, if not great Midwest university, a couple hours from a major city. A lot of passionate people doing a lot of hard work. I would say in this past year, maybe Illinois has been having more financial troubles than Missouri, but everybody's...
Because of the state of Illinois.
Right, yeah. But everyone's dealing with these issues.
Sure.
As we can tell, Wisconsin certainly is among them too. But
right.
A lot of really good students in both places. One of the great fun and great pleasures of teaching is always the students.
Now, do you work mainly with graduate students or also with undergraduates?
Graduate and undergraduate.
Both.
Yeah.
What kind of courses do you teach?
I teach advanced reporting, which is a required class, and then I teach investigative reporting. Those are the two. I've taught something called computer-assisted reporting, but I tend to weave that in. That's database analysis and working with digital information.
Let me give the phone numbers right now for listeners who would like to join this conversation and ask you a question or make a comment. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana. If it's long distance, even if you're listening live on the internet, you can use 1-800-222-9455. So in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Long distance, 1-800-222-WILL. Where did you first begin being a reporter?
I began outside Boston. I'd gone to high school outside Boston and had friends there. And when I went to college in Vermont. And as I was getting out of college, I wanted to write, but I also needed to get paid for it. And friend said, why don't you come down to this town? And the pronunciation in Massachusetts of the town is Woburn, It looks like Woburn. And he said if you like sports, you can do a couple of features, get paid for that, and do a couple of games. And we've got this school board on the side that you can cover. And the more you write about it, the more you'll get paid.
Huh.
And I sort of got the bug after a few months. And, you know, one of those one-year plans turned into a career.
Wow.
And I started stringing for the Boston Globe while I was doing that. And before I knew it, it's 35 years.
Where were you in school in Vermont?
I went to a small college called Bennington College. And the reason I went at that time, way back then, was that there's a real trend to go to some place where the people who taught, whether it was writing or painting or theater, were practitioners of it.
Uh-huh.
And so they would be splitting their time between the profession and teaching.
Wow.
So I was very fortunate, and some terrific writers I got to learn from.
What were some of the most interesting investigative stories you've done over your long career?
Probably one of the more intense ones was looking at the habits of building inspectors in Kansas City way back when the Hyatt Hotel collapsed.
Wow.
It had a couple of skywalls that collapsed and killed 114 people and injured over 200. It was sort of like a plane crash in the middle of the city, and everybody was from the city. And the Kansas City Star not only covered that, but then I was involved in the follow-up investigation on how something like this could happen and where were the inspectors.
Wow.
And it turned out that the inspectors had a lot of bad work habits. The elevator inspector never went into a building taller than one story because he liked to go to one-story bars. Another guy was very industrious. He read Louis L'Amour novels in the Kansas City Library. Another guy.
So these were sinecures. These were just positions where they were getting.
They were supposed to. They were supposed to be going out and inspecting. And when we observed them, they were working on bosses' homes. One guy went to tag sales all day. Another guy.
Yard sales. Yeah.
Yeah. And another guy just drove at 20 miles an hour through the cities all day long.
So you would have to be like a detective and follow these people secretly to find out what they were actually doing?
Yeah, but the interesting thing here is it wasn't like we had a lot of professional people doing it, and we weren't really disturbed if they saw us. And probably the most interesting, surprising thing to me was even after they knew that they were being observed, they couldn't figure out how to work.
Oh, really?
They had lost direction on how to work. And so they complained to their bosses about us observing them, not working.
I see.
So in Kansas City, reacted very strongly. They got rid of about 30 out of 40 inspectors on the first run.
Wow.
And then the amazing thing was we did it a year later, and metropolitan-wide is what I was really involved in, and a third of them were still loafing.
Really?
Right now, this would be the kind of story, of course, that would just drive citizens and taxpayers crazy.
Sure.
And it did at that time because
that was
in the early 80s. So it was during a time of recession.
Recession, yeah.
But more important, this was life and death.
Oh, yeah.
People had died.
Yeah.
And they just lost their way. But there are a lot of others I've done that are not that. It's just a lot of data analysis and documentation, and whether it's been justice or political campaigns or things like that.
Now, you have won prizes and awards for your investigative reporting. What are some of those?
A lot of them have to be – we're focused on performance of government agencies.
Mm-hmm.
Some awards for looking at the Small Business Administration and at that time, their lack of oversight over loans, a lot of big losses of money. Probably one of the most ones that really affected me is I and another reporter who's still at work at the Kansas City Star, but we were working in Hartford, Connecticut at the time. We looked into the state veterans home. We got a tip that the veterans were being mistreated, and we worked on that for about a year, and it had impact, and it was hard to work on because, in fact, the veterans were being badly mistreated. One of the
Was it neglect or was it?
Well, the way they were treating alcoholics, and this was in the mid-1980s, was that they were putting him on a school bus and taking him down to the local liquor store and giving him an allowance to buy liquor. And then they could sit out on crate boxes behind the liquor store all day and get picked up. But occasionally someone would freeze during the winter. That was the beginning of it. They had put a bar in the hospital. So that was their treatment. Then they had veterans who
were... Was that because it was the easiest way to keep them happy?
Yeah. Quiet? And then they would allow... They had what they called sergeants in the barracks. That's what they called them. And the sergeants, when they were drunk, would distribute medication. So they would mix up their medication. The employees were spending a lot of money on things they wanted. And one of the most amazing ones was a member of the board who's vice president of VFW was signing up terminal ill patients to lifetime memberships in the VFW, which meant, of course, you could get the maximum amount of money and deliver the minimum amount of service since the guys would die within a few weeks.
Sure.
It went on and on. But that was we got a lot of letters from family members, people in the state about having done some good work.
Weren't you also in danger in both of those situations from people who didn't want to be watched or didn't want to be found out? I mean, did you ever feel threatened? Were you ever threatened?
Not really. Well, one of the building inspector's sons got pretty anxious one time and tried to run us off the road. But that was no. The U.S., I travel quite a bit. I teach journalists in other countries, and other than when we're down on the Mexican border as U.S. journalists, we have it relatively safe. We get threatened and so forth, but nothing like our colleagues in other countries or our colleagues when they're reporting in some other countries.
Sure.
So, but most of the time people are appreciative of this kind of work. They're, you know, people say journalism is in crisis, but I think that communities really desire to have journalists around when no one else will approach or expose a problem. We are the court of last resort if we're doing our jobs well.
We're talking with Brant Houston, a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, who holds the Knight Chair. That's K-N-I-G-H-T, the Knight Chair in Investigative and Enterprise Reporting in the Department of Journalism at the College of Media. What is enterprise reporting? That's a new term for me.
Well, journalists never agree on the definition of anything, by the way. Investigative reporting has many different definitions to different reporters. Enterprise probably even more. For me, enterprise reporting is really digging into a story, but maybe not with that kind of investigative edge we're talking about, necessarily wrongdoing. I would say, for the most part, a lot of this this project we have, CU Citizen Access, is enterprise reporting. You make more phone calls, you meet more people, you do more interviews, you look at more data or documents than the normal quick story.
Okay. Now, CUCitizenAccess.org is where you're working right now, and we're talking about what you're finding out about poverty in Champaign County. I grew up in this county. I was actually born here. And I've seen poverty a few places in my life. I was gone 20 years during the middle of my life. But in the time I've been here, the church I was pastor of on campus was the home for 17 years of the homeless shelter for men. Before the Times Center was built. So I was co-chair of that committee for many years, and I chaired the City of Champaign's Committee on Homelessness for 4 or 5 years. So we looked into that aspect. Of course, homeless people, many are poor, very poor. Mm-hmm. Others are poor just for a while, and then other people suffer from addictions to drugs or alcohol, or they have mental illness that causes them to be not able to be with family or to have a job and so forth. But I haven't really experienced it. I mean, I've been fortunate in my life not to be that poor. What have you found out already? You've started this, what, in 2009, you said?
Yeah, we started to do the research. And there's actually some – there'll be newer figures out from the census as we – the new census. But there's something called the American Community Survey, and a more recent report, that not based on the census, but this survey actually has shown that the poverty rate in Champaign County, at least I believe it's for individuals, has gone up from 16% to 21% since the last census, which means – you know, and that people would attribute that to the recession.
Sure.
And that's all. And it's still, it's still a, you still have to correct it. There's a bit of debate whether students are counted or how they're counted.
Sure.
Although it's kind of interesting that there's assumption that, well, the students are just going to class. They're not dealing with some of the they're not dealing with poverty issues. But in fact, there are students, and we're looking at a story on that, who are paying their way, just making it by working jobs, and I think that will be
often more than one job.
So we're seeing
and if
that,
their parents had been supporting them, and the parents one or both lose their jobs, how do
exactly,
they stay in school,
yeah,
or what do they do?
Right. I think you can see more manifestations of the problem, the effects of unemployment, the recession at the food banks. I think some of the charitable organizations, if not all. Donations are down and demand is way up. We're finding that. We're finding more people on food stamps than we thought. I believe it's 50%. One out of two students in the public school systems is on subsidized lunches, free or subsidized lunches.
This is the public schools,
Champaign,
K through 12. Yeah.
Yeah. So these are
50%.
Yeah. So these are things you wouldn't quite expect. And what we're also finding is you don't see as much because poverty here tends to be in pockets, whether it's urban or rural. So, you have concentrations. And I think we're working on doing some more sophisticated mapping so people can actually visualize better where poverty is and where the problems and the challenges are.
Champaign-Urbana with roughly, what, 100,000 people plus 40,000 students?
Yeah, I think if the census say, I think we're Champaign-Urbana, what, 110, 120?
So,
yeah,
okay.
we're really getting
But, you know, moderate-sized city maybe, moderate to small even, I guess. But to what extent is there urban poverty in a city of that size? What does that mean?
I think it would mean in the case of this city, one out of 10 people maybe being in extreme poverty, which is significantly below the poverty level.
I see.
Means people being, as I said, on food stamps that you might not suspect. There are a whole number of people that don't have cars that, you know, depend on public transportation system. Fortunately, we have a pretty good one here.
Right.
So there are just these manifestations that come up. And we have not done enough yet what would be called the working poor. People who minimum wage is not going to cover a lot of this.
You really can't pay for an apartment and food and
no, and
minimum wage.
Yeah, so there's some real challenges.
And what about rural poverty? Champaign County, of course, has this rich land all around it and huge farms with corn and soybeans, but where does rural poverty show up? Is that the small towns?
Yeah, the small towns. I think you're starting to see. I think there have been not just us, but articles in the News Gazette about towns that are pretty much disappearing or down to 100, 110, and you know any businesses there have closed or are closing. So that means you've got to move into the city. You got to move somewhere else. There's not work where there used to be.
Some of the towns fairly close to Champaign-Urbana have grown in recent years. Mm-hmm. It seems to me largely as a result of white flight from Champaign-Urbana.
That's the hypothesis. And actually, we've got somebody working on that to see if indeed that's true. Again, this is we tend to approach reporting in a very methodical way, social science way, which is you have a hypothesis and then you gather the evidence. The initial statistics, the data that we've looked at, it appears that since the various court orders and changes and so forth, that the minority population, ethnic diverse population, has gone up in the schools, in the public schools. So if there was an idea of making the schools more integrated through these efforts, the initial data is not showing that that's happened.
Right.
In fact, the reverse has happened.
Because of white flight.
Maybe. We're waiting to find the various causes.
You'll tell us in, what, a year? How long will this study take?
The great thing about journalism is it needs to be a little more immediate. So I'm hoping by May, June.
Oh, really? That's
yeah, if not sooner. The other great thing about journalism is catching history on the fly.
Sure.
So I don't think people have the expectation of a study that goes on for 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
That's very legitimate. And I think journalism is a great profession that you can have incremental learning and incremental stories that build on the next and one. So... And I find that's a very, especially these days, that's a very effective method to go at things, because people have much more access through social media to talk to, get to reporters or anyone working on a story like that. And we want them involved.
I want to ask some questions about how trustworthy information is that we get off social media, but that's just a minor question. But we're about halfway through our talk today with our guest, Professor Brant Houston, that's Houston, from the University of Illinois College of Media in the Journalism Department, and he holds the Knight Chair in Investigative and Enterprise Reporting. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Let me give the phone numbers again, and after a short bit of announcements I want to make. We'll take calls if there are any. 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, if it's a local call here in the 217 area code. If it's long distance, do use 1-800-222-9455. And if you've missed part of this program, you can, of course, hear it in about a week or so on our website. You can get a podcast at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And we leave the G off of keeping to be informal, so it's /keepingthefaith. The University YMCA has sponsored, been a partial sponsor for this program for several years, and coming up at the Y this week on the 22nd, 2 days from now, on Tuesday, Lisa Gay Dixon, professor from the theater department at the University of Illinois, will be talking about A Midsummer Night's Dream. It's a bacchanal. That's at noon at the University of Y, a free lecture. If you'd like to get some of the good Thai food there, you can call in at 337-1500 or just show up and they'll find some for you, or bring your own lunch, or simply come to hear that free lecture. And then March 1st, the following Tuesday, E. Black Champaign-Urbana and Community Informatics, Using Technology and Information to Connect and Empower, from the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, Nora Lindstra will be talking about that very mysterious subject. Also at the Y is Friday Forum, and this week, as part of their series on Americans at War, a look at the impacts of U.S. military power in the 21st century, Jonathan Ebel, professor of religion here at the University of Illinois, will be talking about the things they buried, the religious dynamics of remembering and forgetting America's war dead. That's this Friday noon at the University Y. That's the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street. There are plenty of buses that get you there very easily. Just get off the university library and walk half a block, or you can, around noon, often find parking spaces when students take off from where they've been in classes in the morning. So, some free lectures at the University Y. Every third Thursday, Global Lens 2011, also at the University Y. A story that reveals the world. Global Lens presents an extraordinary series of 10 international films, free and open to anyone. And the International Dinner, that's an annual event at the Y, comes up March 13. People should mark their calendars for that great event. That'll be Sunday night, 6 p.m., right after Keeping the Faith on March 13. On Keeping the Faith, next week our guest will be Elizabeth Buckley. Dr. Buckley had her debut at Carnegie Hall as a soprano in the last month. She'll be talking about using music for advocacy and outreach. That's February 27th here on Keeping the Faith. On March 6th, our guest will be Clayton Doffenbaugh talking about ecology. And March 13, we're very pleased to have Professor Joel Green and Professor Lib Caldwell, who have worked together on the new Common English Bible, along with a whole team of folks. That's coming out just this year. It's a new translation of the whole Bible, and that'll be March 13. Joel Green is from Fuller Theological Seminary, and Lib Caldwell is from a seminary in Chicago. They'll be talking with us by phone. Those are some of the programs coming up ahead on Keeping the Faith. Let's get back to our guest, Brant Houston. Brant, I mentioned before I started talking about things at the University of Y about all these things we learn via social media. You're trying to find out things through websites and Facebook and things like that. But people do research now using the internet. But what's trustworthy and how could they know?
Again, one of those excellent questions and one of the things we're all trying to resolve. There are some basic ways at establishing credibility, and especially people and researchers and library information science have talked about it. One of the things you want to do is always consider the source. And
The News Gazette is a Republican paper. We just need to realize that.
Right. Well, what's interesting is that there's been this illusion over the years that media would be without bias. That's the very choice of a story indicates some kind of bias.
Sure.
What you count on is people being able to recognize it and, once again, to give you information based on research and maybe having a hypothesis, but being willing to change the conclusion if the evidence doesn't support it. We're in a world right now where there are a whole number of people that are looking for facts to support their opinion.
Right.
So one of the things we're trying to do as journalists now is reestablish the standards of credibility. So, for example, if you're looking at a domain site that's ends in .gov, well, you at least have pretty good indication that that's government information and as good or bad as it's ever been. But you know that there's a certain expectation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. .org, you'll probably be, it'll be a nonprofit. You learn to look up backgrounds on things. For example, if I were checking out a nonprofit I might give to, I could actually go to a free service, GuideStar.org. Which gives you a lot of financial information on how money is spent. So really you're finding out that there are a lot of watchdogs already on the web. So you're learning some of the people that destroy urban myths and urban legends and things like that. But a key part, which we teach in reporting, is to cross-reference. One source doesn't do it. At a minimum, you want to have three sources. You want to have as many sources as you can to paint a complete picture. Truth is often evasive, so you have to work at to find out what's really going on. But there is a lot of good information out there. The bad news is that anybody can throw anything up there. The good news is a lot of people see it all at once and discuss whether it's valid or not. So it's good to wait a little bit, to let the information brew a little and then see the comments on it. So you've got an advantage there.
Uh-huh.
But always it's consider the source and research the source.
In my field of sort of specialty, religion, during my training, I was, taught to try to go back as far as you can to get original sources. That's actually easier now because of things like the internet, and yet it's sometimes hard to tell whether that original source has been tampered with when you find it on the internet. It's a little different if you go to the rare book room of the library and see that book that actually was published in 1715 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But on the internet, it's so hard to know. And Wikipedia, for example, you know, people go there first often for information, and it can be changed with just 30 people who write in. You know?
Right. It's a good tip sheet. It's not a bad start because people start footnoting what they put on Wikipedia, and so you're able to get back to some of those primary documents.
Right.
But there are archives that have been digitized. I mean, we've got a school that's the Library Information Science School. It's a leader in this. And so there are standards now for the archiving of information.
Uh-huh.
And so once again, you can figure out who actually did the digitizing and where it is, and you can get back to those original documents even if they've been digitized.
Uh-huh.
But you bring up a good point. We're constantly teaching the journalists, you know, get back to the primary sources, the primary documents. Secondary documents are great. A newspaper is often a secondary document unless there's original investigative or enterprise work. So we're in a disadvantage of doing that. I've had students that have gone to the libraries in town to look up information on the Ameren site, the one where there's a lot of controversy and about the cleanup. So, you know, we're teaching them get back into the actual libraries.
Find
so we
out.
Haven't given up on hard copy.
I noticed in my area, again, of religion, that the New Yorker has a very long investigative results of an investigation of one of the newer religions that started in this country. And it's one that's been very hard to investigate because this particular religious group has a lot of money, and if they don't like what you're doing, they could sue you. And mm-hmm. people have, you know, how do you defend yourself against a huge organization with a lot of money? Is that a problem these days? More of a problem?
Yeah, it is. One of the things I've been also involved with is the creation of something called the Investigative News Network. And that is a consortium of nonprofit, national, and state journalism centers that produce nonpartisan investigative work. And one of our big issues is making sure to have affordable media insurance and also to make sure that these journalists, many of whom have migrated from mainstream newsrooms, have good legal representation. What changed over the years is in the last 20 years is if you were going to be sued, you're going to be sued after the work appeared.
Right.
Legal strategy changed so that you could also have people coming after you legally during the news gathering event or be sued for your news, having your news gathering methods challenged. There have been instances of one of the what's been one of the good great investigative centers in the U.S., the Center for Public Integrity, lost its insurance after being sued by targets of investigation from Russia, who spent millions of dollars suing them, did not win the case, but the attrition on the center's insurance, its legal team, and so forth meant that they then had to put together a special legal defense fund and arrange with several top attorneys to work for them pro bono if they were sued again. So this is real. I mean, it's a real threat that if someone comes after you, is to have some kind of resources to defend yourself.
Sure.
You know, there are a lot of Pyrrhic victories now where a newsroom has been found to have done everything right, but the cost to prove that and to defend that is just overwhelming.
Wow.
So there are a lot of challenges.
Sure are. When students come to a school of journalism like this these days, it used to be that you knew that there were some good opportunities at the Kansas City Star, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Times, the Post, whatever, Chicago Tribune, LA, Sun Times, whatever. But these days, all of those places have shrunk. What do you tell students now who have this bug, as you called it, that got you early on? What are their chances for finding actual work, doing what they want to do?
It is a tough time, but there are ways to be fairly sure that you are going to find work. The demand that can't be filled out there are people who have the talents to work with data, to do some data analysis, to do web design, to post material on the web in interesting interactive ways,
sure.
to have some multimedia talents. There's still hiring going on, but it is you're not going to have a planned path now. And the one thing that remains, the one cliche that does remain is content is king, or depending on your point of view, queen or whatever. But but content really matters. The all these startups and these multimedia companies are just dying for good content. What we found in the Investigative News Network is there are some very large media companies interested in syndicating the work or distributing the work. Because content is making a difference. So I initially told students the media will change, the particular medium you might work in may change, but if you have the content and you stay flexible, you'll be able to take care of the skills, because students learn so quickly by themselves too. What we can teach you is the content on how to get credible information, information that matters to people, information that people want that'll make their life better or protect them.
And what about the skill with words? I mean, how basic?
Still there. Probably you have to be even more eloquent, because you may have to do a story in fewer words than you might have before.
Uh-huh.
There's been some trend to think about writing now is writing screenplays.
Huh.
Because if you were to write a screenplay, you have in your mind, well, there's a video, there's a shot here. Well, now you can get that audio and that video
sure.
and part of the story. So, but you still have to be concerned about pacing. You still have to be very concerned to make sure you have people in these stories. I mean, we're people writing about people for people.
Right.
So that sensitivity to the word really still matters a great deal.
I have a niece that's in art history out in on the West Coast as an undergraduate. And I recently saw a little video she made as a birthday present for one of her friends at school. It was fascinating. It got your attention. It had words. It had images. It was a wonderful little 4 or 5 minute piece. And she's not a journalist. She's sort of an artist. But she used words very effectively in that video piece.
She's up to speed on the modern world.
Uh-huh.
I think as a faculty, one of the great things about being a faculty member or a teacher is it ensures that you have to work at keeping up with things. You can't keep doing the same lessons. So I'm not – in fact, I was in a discussion this past weekend with some other night chairs, some others doing this, and we were coming to the conclusion that we didn't have to worry about any student's comfort level with multimedia. With those are the tools. What we're talking about is how do you tell the story effectively? How are you credible?
Yeah.
Where the documents are.
Huh.
I still remember in my first year here, someone had died, and they had an obit in the Daily Illini, but there was no age.
Huh.
And a couple of my students were in the class. I said, "Why didn't you put the age in? You've got to put an age in an obituary. Everybody wants to know that, and it has an impact on people. Invaluable information." And they said, "Well, we couldn't get a hold of the family. We're unsure what we found on the web."
Right.
And I said, "Well, didn't this person have a Facebook page?" And they said, "No, they were in their 50s. They were old."
I see.
And I said, "Well, let's take a look." And we went to their page, and their exact birth date was
their
there.
Birthday.
Right.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, maybe we can bring along the idea of gathering information
check.
And use what you have.
Find a second source, because – somebody, they might have, if the person made their own Facebook page, they might have cheated.
Oh, no, no. I spent a fair amount of time at the Kansas City Star writing obituaries because when I was there doing general assignment. And what I was saying to my students, it's much easier to call up a family and say that you're confirming an age.
Yes, absolutely.
As opposed to, and a birth date, as opposed to saying, asking what it is.
Right.
And I have found I made a lot of calls during one time of my career, and I found that family members were very happy to, not happy, but they were okay with getting a call to confirm a fact about the deceased.
Newspapers to survive are finding all kinds of different ways to make money, and one way they make money nowadays is families can write their own obit on a family member who's died. And it can leave out that very interesting and important information. But the newspapers have found, well, if we print it the way the family writes it, we can charge them for it. What do you think about that?
On a personal level, I wouldn't do it. Yeah. I'm not going to criticize some of my colleagues or former colleagues
that are trying
to survive in this. I don't think you make enough money on that. I mean, for newspapers to survive, I don't even say newspapers now, I say newsrooms.
All right.
Even the American Society of Newspaper Editors is now known as the American Society of News
Editors.
Okay. We have to have a complete change of how we think about the ways that we'll bring in revenue that will pay the bills.
Right.
The advertising that went to the web is never coming back, and it's never going to be paid for the way it was in print, at least at this point that we can tell.
Before.
Yeah. So,
I love newspapers. I love to hold them in my hand. I love the fact that I can quickly look at headlines and see what I want to read and what I don't want to read. I can avoid all the ads if I want. I should let advertisers hear that. But, I love that about papers and news magazines and
for those of us who didn't grow up with the web, I don't think we'll ever really want to give them up. But if you look at the demographics and what's going on for people under 40, if they're going to deal with something that we are familiar with as a newspaper, probably the closest thing I've seen to it right now is on a tablet, an iPad, or some kind of tablet. But everyone's younger generations are going at information in a much different way. Quick glances at certain information, and then an intense interest
in certain things.
And when they will research it as much as the best reporter in the world.
Yeah, we're down to our last 8 or 9 minutes. We still have time for a question or two from callers. The numbers are 333-9455. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area. If you're farther away, it's a long-distance call, punch in 1-800-222-9455 to talk with our guest, Professor Brent Houston from the College of Media Journalism Department, where he teaches investigative and enterprise reporting. When you were at the Kansas City Star, there was a religion writer there named Bill Timaeus, who's a friend of mine. Did you know Bill by chance?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Definitely I was there. Bill was writing columns and occasionally doing stories at that time.
Uh-huh.
And when I went to the Hartford Courant, there was another religion writer had come from Kansas City, Jerry Renner, who did some very fine work. He had worked for the Catholic Reporter.
Yes, National Catholic Reporter, also out of Kansas City.
Correct. And so I've been fortunate to work with a couple of the best religion writers around.
Now, why do you care whether there's been wrongdoing? You said that an investigative reporter really focuses on wrongdoing. What's wrong these days? I mean, isn't everything relative? I mean, how do you know what to look for?
I've thought about it a long time because you wonder why you spend long hours on things and then you teach other people to do it. I think the drive is a basic sense of fairness. And I think some people get to a point in life in which they say, well, that's just the way the world works. And I'm always saying the investigative journalists tend not to grow up. They're still a little bit of the adolescent or even younger than that. And you tell them something and they go, why? And if they don't think it's fair. They keep asking why this happened and so forth. And so I think there's something in the personality makeup, and it just goes with the territory. I've actually wrote a fairly long article about the future of investigative journalism recently, and I did more research than I ever had. I practiced it for a long time, but never has much time to research it. And actually, the investigative journalism that we know really came out of England in the 16th century and out of a lot of the religious radicals, the New Testament folks. And so in the background of Western investigative journalism, there really was a religious element. And in fact, the muckrakers in the late 19th century were very religious, but you wouldn't know it because they were also lashing out against what they saw as the corruption of organized religion and what had happened to organized religion. But they were actually very religious themselves. So you hope it's not zealotry. You hope it's passion and care for people. But at the base of it is an outrage over the unfairness of things, whether it's larger people beating up weaker people, powerful taking advantage of weaker people. It's something in the genetic makeup of those people, I would say.
So coming from that kind of a motivation, why did you choose, of all things, to study poverty in the counties surrounding the University of Illinois and Urbana-Champaign? Where's the unfairness?
I think what you do when you look at an issue like this is you get a lot of general agreement. Not everyone agrees, but that poverty is a bad thing. It's a bad thing for the community in general. It's bad for the people. It's terrible for the people who are impoverished. It also has an effect on the environment you're in. It's a reflection of society and of the kind of society you want to have. So it leads to looking at how a government program works, a charity program works or doesn't work, whether people are receiving the services that have been promised to them, whether they're getting help that will help them help themselves. There are a lot of issues there. And then a lot of it comes back to children. They haven't created this. And when you've got lots of children on free and subsidized lunches or going in and out of foster homes or homeless, there are hundreds of homeless school children in this county, and the number has really grown. And that isn't something you necessarily would know.
Right.
So those kinds of things, I think it was something – it wasn't simply looking at statistics. I talked to people. I talked to the News Gazette. I talked to other media. And there was a general concern that maybe we needed more help in taking a closer look at these issues, especially a time for mainstream media that there's terrible cost cutting.
But that sounds so compassionate. What happened to the hard-bitten, hard-drinking reporter?
They're probably trying to find one of those disappearing jobs at the State House, which is a whole other issue we have is the State House staffs have gone way down.
Sure. Who's watching government?
Yeah, and investigative journalism is ideologically a little schizophrenic. You have compassion, and then you have the fiscal conservative parts of investigative reports, fraud, waste, and abuse. So you will have a lot of different kinds. Yeah.
We have a caller waiting on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Brent Houston.
Good evening. Really important subject, and I really want to sort of applaud the program for how intelligently you frame the questions and how, what a sophisticated sort of view you helped me to attain to. I mean, it's really a nice conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Do you have a question you'd like to ask as well? Oh, apparently he just wanted to say something nice. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Nice day.
Brad, I'm all upset because I'm not used to getting compliments.
Right, right. It
throws me off.
Believe me, you'll throw a reporter off. Which is actually untrue. A reporter, you can be very liked one day when you've really done something for a community, and then You know, there are a lot of days. I tell my students what you really want to hope for is respect, is to be respected for being fair and credible and so forth. But being liked, that changes from day to day and story to story.
Very true. Yeah. We're down to our last couple of minutes. Let me ask if you've had any surprises so far in your look at poverty in this county.
Yeah, I think I've mentioned some of them. The great thing about being a reporter is it brings with it a lot of humility. You just feel stupid all the time because you think you really should have known something. I would say the number of school children who are homeless, really, that one really took me aback.
Wow.
And that there's been an increase in that, and that we'll be looking at that more. I would say that was one, and I would say obviously just the numbers and the increase. I think a lot of people feel that a relatively small city in the Midwest that has a major university is fairly recession-proof.
Right.
And I think we've all been surprised with the Great Recession how that kind of overrode this. Certainly we're not in the dire straits of some other communities, but it's hit it hard. And so that's been – I think that's been a little bit of a surprise too.
Sure. So. You're doing this project very collaboratively, and you mentioned other people who are working on it. Let me give the website again for people who would like to keep up with this as it progresses and perhaps contribute to it. cu-citizenaccess.org. Mm-hmm. And what will people find when they get to that site?
You'll find a great number of stories. A lot of them are being what we call visualized. There's a lot of mapping, a lot of photos. We've broken it out, and I won't name them, into just so we can manage the information. It is 16 focus areas, jobs, economics, food, those kinds of things, poverty overall. So you can go there and look for stories and information in an area you're interested in. Everything's changed. Everybody thinks that everyone starts at a website on the homepage, but actually the traffic goes for specific information inside. Okay. So there should be a lot for everyone.
And people who go to that website, cu-citizenaccess.org, can find ways also to contribute suggestions, leads, ideas, information.
Right. And you also can ask to be on the newsletter list. We have a little summing up, so you can get alerts and you can get a newsletter. So, we all have limited time, and I love alerts and newsletters telling me what's going on. So you can get that weekly.
Well, thank you very much for being on our program, and let me encourage listeners to join in this process, this study, if you're in the Champaign County area, at cu-citizenaccess.org. And I want to thank Professor Brent Houston for being our guest today on Keeping the Faith. Coming up next week, we'll be talking with Elizabeth Buckley about advocacy and outreach through music. That's the 27th of February. On March 6th, our guest will be Clayton Doffenbaugh. And he's recently done some very interesting work in southern Utah, one of the most beautiful parts of our country, and is concerned about what's happening to the ecology there. He'll be reporting on that March 6th here on Keeping the Faith. March 13th, we'll be talking about the Common English Bible. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.